This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Amadhin, and this is Kelly and Ramya.
This is Style and Great Conversation. It's AMI's on-air community, and everyone's invited.
Here we go. It's a Monday, and we're back here doing the hosting for Kelly and Ramya. Today, Grant Hardy joining me on the program. Ramya is still away on assignment for our show, taking general, ladies and gentlemen. Grant, howdy. How are you today?
Doing good today for a Monday. Good to be back with you. We've done this quite often lately with the Kelly and Grant show here, but we'll get back to a little more normality on the show tomorrow. How's it going?
Well, excellent. I remember in our conversation on Friday's show with our gardener, Susan Kearney, we were talking about the cherry blossoms, and I made mention that, well, I'm going to go out on a tandem bike ride and do that little kind of search. Are they available? Well, they aren't. When I went out, really didn't have a lot happening here, but again, have had so much rain kind of falling, and the rain has kind of been wiping that away, as we talked about. And when we were discussing how short the window is for them in a lot of cases, it's that, oh, there it is. The blooms, they're here. Oh, voila, some rain, it's gone. And really interesting to think about. When I was on the ride the other day, my captain and I were talking about that, and I was looking forward to it, Grant, but alas, no sniffing the air, no going through and having allergic reactions or anything like that. So I'm sure, I think we're still yet to have that here in the city of London, Ontario. And others out there might be telling me, no, man, what part of town are you in? But, have you noticed in your travels yet? Have you had the experience, especially now that we're talking about it?
Yeah, I can't really say I have. It's been pretty rainy and gross here as well. So I'm thinking maybe just that the short window, like you said, but also just how delicate they are. Really sure how they're doing here, but we always got a lot of buzz when things start blooming with spring here. Everyone's talking about it, so I will definitely hear about it and keep posted right away.
Well, we'll also check in with Carol Yapel at the beginning of our second hour for our committee report today from Vancouver. We'll see what she has experienced, if anything yet. She's always keeping her nose, eyes, and what have you on those blossoms. Let's take a look at what we've got else on the program today. We catch up with host of the AMI original podcast, Low Vision Moments. Jenny Bovart will be with us. She's going to highlight the recent episode, Run for Your Life, with guest Daryl, and the experience of her first half marathon.
And Power to Be is a Vancouver Island-based nonprofit offering outdoor programs for all abilities. We're going to learn more on that community report with Carol.
Oh, man. Out in the fresh air, wonderful. And in light of the high-profile criminal trial of former President Trump taking place in New York, Danielle McLaughlin is going to take us through what happens in the U.S. and Canada when you, I, Grant, whomever out there is called for jury duty. We'll get into that conversation with her in hour two, right here on Kelly and Ramya. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved a new medical device that could potentially help people who live with extreme pain.
The FDA signed off on an implantable pain control device. Its maker, Medtronic, says it responds to the body's pain signals in real time. Neurologists say that could be a major step forward in treating persistent chronic pain, but it may not be for everyone. The device must be surgically implanted, so it may only be recommended for those who have exhausted all other options. The CDC says 17 million Americans live with high-impact chronic pain, which interferes with everyday life. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Grant, anything, because we know how demigrating the pain can be. It just interferes with everything, whether it's sit-down pain, whether it's stand-up pain, whether it's just constant body ache or other conditions out there that really work on you. I like to see something like this come about because I don't really know what's all out there other than medications, and a lot of people, this kind of pain that we're talking, may not even touch it. And how long does someone... Can someone's body tolerate some of the meds?
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing worse than pain at the end of the day. People who have severe chronic pain, and it's both the pain and the process, like the politics of, you know, are we giving out these drugs? Or are we trying to restrict people from taking them? You know, are we even going to kind of take you seriously with your pain when you come to the doctor? There are just so many circumstances that are going on. And although this sounds a little extreme because you've got to have it implanted, maybe for those serious cases, or just really bringing anything like this that really brings the discussion forward, at least, and advances pain relief into the 21st century here is sounds good to me.
I'm anxious to find out the process, where it goes, how concerning is doing the actual procedure to implant it, if there's any. And those, the percentage of people, and again, obviously this is for high pain, this is probably for certain conditions of pain, circumstances of pain, without getting into the details in the piece there, and probably obviously you can look it up and learn for ourselves on this, but going off the top of my head, I do wonder on how effective is it expected to be? Are there those people that will literally say, hey man, this suppresses it so much, I can go out and do and function and do some of the things. Will it take it away for some people? And again, will we be in a circumstance with more than not where it may not touch a person's pain, where it may not be a good device? And I mean, that hopefully this is just the beginning. Hopefully we're going to hear so many positive things. But again, I know some people that say, hey, you're not doing a surgery on me. You're not putting anything in my body like that. I think that's in itself going to be that task of finding those who are willing, and hopefully it's not a chancy procedure. We will step aside for a couple of moments, folks. Up next on the program, Michael Babcock shares tips for using Microsoft Outlook with JAWS, touching on creating signatures in folders, flagging messages, and getting started on inbox rules. Boy, I know all about that stuff. We'll find out more and what he's got for us on the subjects after this, as we begin another week on Kelly and Rumya. I know we're past it, folks, but just to give you a reason to look forward, the next weekend, check out the best of Kelly and Rumya on AMI TV. If, you know, the show's a little hard to find, whether it's one of the repeats or our live edition on AMI TV or the first edition on AMI Audio, remember, we compile some segments and put them together for Saturday and Sunday broadcasts and call it the best of Kelly and Rumya. So do check that out when you have some time. Enjoy the show any way you can, at any time you can. We appreciate you riding along. Sitting in with me, speaking of riding along this week, today to kick the week off, that is Grant Hardy.
And one reason to look forward to Mondays is we get lots of tech updates, and it is time to talk tech with Mike Babcock.
App news, device reviews, security advice, and more. It's time to talk tech with me, Michael Babcock. Get your dose of ever-changing technology knowledge right here on Kelly and Rumya.
Hey, Michael. Fantastic to be chatting with you again.
Hey, Grant, Kelly. How are the two of you guys doing?
I think for a Monday, not too bad. Not too bad. Hope you're having a good start to your week as well. I want to dive in and talk about Microsoft Outlook. It's one of these programs that most folks are like me out there, I just literally read and reply to emails. I'm not aware of all these powerful features that can really change your life and make it easier. So let's just talk about Outlook. First of all, are you using Windows more lately? And can you share some tips with Outlook and JAWS?
Yeah, so Lenovo sent me an X1 Carbon laptop to experiment with and try out because they've added some tactile dots to some keys on the laptop keyboard. Mm-hmm. Side note, it's actually a lot more productive or useful than I thought it would be, especially for finding the volume keys, because I never remember, is it F2 or F7 to turn down the volume? So it has a vertical line on the left side of volume down and on the right side of volume up, which makes it super nice. But right, that meant that I had to set the Mac aside and spend more time on Windows. And I begrudgingly did that. And I think I'm going to stick with Windows for a while because I'm finding productivity tools like what I found in Outlook. So I haven't gone through all of the settings, and I've done some basic changes, and I'll go over some of these with people. And when Kelly was mentioning he was familiar with rules, I might have to pick his brain a little bit about some rules. But before we get
good
there,
luck we'll with that, Icon IT, and hey guys, can you work on this for me? Hey Matt Agnew, when you got a moment, could you work with me on this rule?
Just
handy.
Just set it up. I'll complain if it doesn't work. We're good if it does work.
And I'll give you the time to go and fix it if it doesn't work.
It looks like it's gotten easier, though, because what I remember when I went last and looked at putting up rules, it was kind of a pain to figure out how is it that these rules need to get up. So let's talk something real quick that everyone needs, and that is, I think everyone needs, and that's a signature. For those who don't know, this is the text that goes below your message when you're done writing it. If you want to set up your signature, press Alt-F to go up to the file menu. Go to the options option, and then in options, go down to the mail section. When you're in mail, you can press the tab key through the 20,000 items. There's really not that many there, but it sure seems like it when you're pressing tab. Or press Alt-N to quickly, that's in like November, to quickly jump to the signatures option and then press the space bar to activate it. When you're in signatures, use Alt-A or tab to add new signature and give the signature a name. This then will give you an opportunity to pick. Do you want this to go above all of your or at the bottom of all of your messages? Do you want it to be skipped over when you're forwarding a message or when you're replying to a message? And then you can also configure your signature, which means you can add text, format that text like you normally would in an Outlook email. Assign the alignment. So if you want it to be centered all the time, then you can do that. By default, it's assigned to the left. And you can add pictures and links to that signature as well. When you're done configuring that signature, I forgot to mention you can pick the email account that signature applies to if you have multiple
that's
email
helpful.
Accounts. Tab to OK, and then tab to OK, and then you have your signature set up.
And you can obviously edit that at some point if you did needed to, especially with having that name in case you had a couple.
Yeah. So you can go back and edit them for sure. Or, positions change. People get promotions. Yep. So you might want the same signature, just a new title underneath your name. So you can go in and edit those.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask if either of you guys flag messages, because I did not.
I don't, and I've always thought that it could be more useful than I imagine. I just really haven't thought about how it would fit into my workflow.
So I think my issue with it was I didn't know what happens to these messages after I flag them. So if you don't know what flagging is, this is, you can give it a color and it'll have your attention brought to it. I imagine some way visually with JAWS, JAWS says that it's flagged and what color it is. And you can do this by pressing Shift F10 on the message, go down to the option or actually press the letter U to take you to the submenu. And this will give you the option to flag a message and you press enter on that. Then when you're going through your inbox, JAWS will speak that message is flagged. And I'm like, okay, that's good. I have 800 messages. What I need is a little bit of extra verbosity to tell me something in my inbox. So what I discovered is if you shift tab twice from the inbox, from the message list, you'll hear sort, arrange, or filter messages button. And if you press space on that long title, you'll get the option that I have changed to every once in a while that says filter by flagged, arrange by date. And what that will do is filter out all of the messages that aren't flagged. So it'll only show you those messages that you've flagged and give it to you in the date sorting, which I currently have mine set to most recent at top. And so then I can view all of the messages that I have flagged and take action on them. I probably need to play with this a bit more, but with this and rules, I think there could be some ways to quickly filter out the important messages messages that you need to be able to see, take action on them, and then go back to the main inbox view. And when I discovered that, I'm like, huh, Outlook could be a little bit more productive than I initially thought.
And I had wondered if you can search them that way too. And it's funny you mention about, it seems to be the way we put most recent at the top. But I think when I started working years ago with Outlook, everything was at the bottom. I think my newest stuff, I preferred it at the bottom. It's funny our choices.
Now we just want to see what's come in since last time I'd looked at this pile of mail. At least that's
it's got to be.
Do you guys do anything with folders?
Yeah, I got to say, yeah, but not really. But sometimes I've had to make one, but I don't really, I'm not great at finding things. So I'm too, I'm too afraid. Oh,
gotcha. I'm literally like those inbox zero people. I am the opposite of that. I've got thousands of messages in my inbox. I just kind of do the best I can. No real folders or organization. Hope you're not maybe listening, flagging my boss.
Maybe flagging should be an important part of that strategy, or a rule to flag or move
the
messages.
Rule. So, definitely.
Like you guys, I've not really done anything with folders. I did find out though, if you hit F6, you can get to a list of your folders. Press Shift F10 on the main folder that you want to make a folder inside of. So that might be an email account, and then go to new folder. And if you didn't know, this is a handy keystroke that would be useful. Is Control plus Y will bring you to a list of your folders. So if you've automatically moved messages to a folder using a rule, then you can get to that folder by using the Control Y. And then rules, we'll go over that real quick on how to set that up. If you find a message that you want to set a rule up on, for example, let's say I want all of the messages that come from this boss to go to this boss folder. You can locate that boss's email, press Shift F10 on it, go down to locate the rules option, and then you're able to create a rule based on who the message was from and tell it, either flag it, move it, or automatically reply and say, yes, I'm busy, hardworking.
I'm working on this. Hey, you just changed my life. I'm going to do that with all my emails. Yes, I'm getting right on this. Don't bother me about this.
I actually kind of like it. I kind of like the folder. I kind of like the rule for it, because it really, at first, I remember I was getting a bunch of stuff going to the inbox, and we discussed this rule thing. And oh, man, it makes life a lot easier in that sense. But again, it was at first that thing, Michael, I was kind of nervous of. Okay, what else should we know?
Yeah. So the next thing that I think we should be aware of is how to organize the information that's presented to a user while you're navigating. Now, this specifically is for JAWS. If you press JAWS key V to go into the quick settings, and then you can down arrow to go ahead and choose the option that says messages. When you go to message status and you open that, you can pick if you want the status of the message read to you. Do you want to know if this is a flagged message? Do you want to know if this is unread? Do you want to know if you've replied or forwarded this message? I have replied and forwarded on, so I know if I've taken action on it. Otherwise, I don't want to hear the rest of that information. Right. I do still have flagged on because I want to play with that a little bit. But right now, I don't want to hear if it's unread, because if it's still in my inbox, it's either unread or it's read, but have I replied to it? That's all I care about. And then if you go up to the view menu, you can go to the view options and customize this by choosing the columns button. And when you go into columns, you can reorganize the order that the columns are in your inbox. So me, for example, I have mine set to read me, or the first column is the subject. The second column is the person. And then the third column is the date. And that's how it reads it out to me. So I can quickly navigate through by subject line. And if the subject doesn't sound interesting to me, then I can easily delete that. And or listen to see, because, you know, if you're getting these spam emails, you're pretty familiar with the subject lines that you're used to hearing. And so for me, I found that to be a more quicker way to get through Outlook inbox.
Okay.
That would work regardless of screen reader, because that's an Outlook feature. Yeah.
Right. And I think it defaults when it comes to red or not red, and forward. If you do forward, it'll default to having that on. Michael, you reference these tips from a JAWS perspective. However, can these skills be used by other screen readers, especially what we just mentioned there?
You can. The only, so most of these keystrokes, including the Shift F10 and setting up the rules and moving messages and the Control Y, can, they're Outlook specific. They're not screen reader specific. Now, going in and configuring some of the settings, such as what information is read to you related to the message status, I think you can use in other screen readers, but that specifically mentioned today was a JAWS feature. The ability to go in and reorganize the columns in the folder that you're in is an Outlook feature. So you, no matter what screen reader you're using, can go in and do that and customize that experience that you receive while awesome. You're navigating your messages.
Brilliant. I mm-hmm. honestly found it interesting what you said. I'm an unabashed Apple fanboy, but when I play with Windows and JAWS, there is so much power there that I feel like my next computer is maybe going to be a PC at home. We're a little tight on time here. Sorry, I ended on kind of a dramatic note there. Looking forward to chatting about Python in the future. I know that's one of my brother's favorite subjects. Meanwhile, we'll let you go for now. But thanks for giving us some tips on Outlook, Michael.
Of course, and go back and listen to the podcast if you're like, what did he say? What was that keystroke? Check off the Kelly and Romeo podcast.
Yeah, thanks,
Michael.
We will. I'm going to slow it down to like 0.5 speed so I can get it all. All right. Michael joins us every Monday to talk all things tech.
Up next, regular physical exercise reduces the risk of dementia by promoting both cardiovascular health and social engagement. On trending headlines with that guy there, Grant Hardy, we're going to learn about 5 ways to reduce our risk of dementia through lifestyle in 2 minutes. Welcome back to the program. Kelly and Ramya here. The studio in Toronto, vacant today, because Ramya isn't here. But the show, Kelly and Ramya, is here. Okay, I had to sort that out, Grant. Grant Hardy, he's here in Vancouver at the, quote, home studio, unquote. Kelly McDonald here at the home studio, London, Ontario. And Grant, one of the things we were talking about on the break is a lot of those hotkeys for Outlook that JAWS users are familiar with, a lot of them have been the same for years, decades, like since it came out to be in its original form, Outlook and so on, or Microsoft, what was it called? Oh my good heavens. Microsoft Outlook, but it had the other original name to it that we had to wipe from our brains. But the shortcut keys have been changed a little to obviously be able to accommodate, but so much of it has been so similar and so the same for the longtime users. So I love that as someone who's used it for a long time.
It's so true. I remember, like years and years ago, even when they switched from the menu bar to the big ribbon thing, they said, like, if you've actually memorized like a specific, you know, key sequence that you just push out of muscle memory, like actually you've made it so a lot of those still work, which is very kind of them, really.
In the original Outlook Express and stuff, that's what I'm thinking. That's the way it was.
Remember that. So simple, but worked a little bit better for my simple little brain.
Well, and that whole thing was, it was fast. It would take care with combining everything like this, lickety split. Folks, it's that time. On Mondays, we kick the show also off by talking headlines with Grant. So let's get to it.
Hey, I'm Grant Hardy, and welcome to the Headlines segment. I tackle everything from health and lifestyle to accessibility and tech. I have it all right here on Kelly and Ramya.
You know, we talk a lot about the different health conditions that are out there, Grant, and I think so many of us, because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we're someone who is going to have any form of dementia. And you just have no idea. Some will say, if your grandfather had, and that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about it today.
We are, yeah. And originally this used to be kind of like a health and lifestyle segment, really. And I don't talk about health as much as I maybe should anymore. And given, I have some people close in my life who are going through dementia. I also know very well that I have it in my genes, touch wood. Just figured I would, I found an article that presented some tips on reducing your risk of dementia. Nothing really groundbreaking, to be honest. But the first one is just regular physical activity, especially walking with a buddy. Both promotes cardiovascular health, and also it's good social activity as well. Healthy diet, fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, whole grains, basically all the stuff that I don't eat. Lowers the risk of cognitive decline. And this one is really interesting, and then I'll let you comment on it. Mentally stimulating activity. So basically things mm-hmm. that either stimulate your brain or even that your brain is telling you not to do. So everything from like puzzles to learning a new language, learning a new skill. Basically, I think I've heard this saying before, like rage against the machine, like all these things that your brain is telling you are too hard. Those are things that keep the brain sharp and can delay the onset of dementia.
It's interesting, Grant, because I used to feel that I had enough exercise. We were talking about this last week about phone numbers, for example. We were having the conversation with Nazreen. And how that helped exercise the mind, help reminding myself of meetings, dates, appointments, whatever it might be, before we had this wonderful computer that did, and phone over here, that did everything for us that way. And now you have to almost go out of your way to find that thing, such as learning a language. And that's what I've thought. If I really get myself to where I need to get back to that, I mean, I used to figure line learning for plays and haven't been in a play in a while. So that dawns on me of, oh my gosh, if I had to go learn lines for a play, that'd be a struggle. But if failing that, maybe learning another language, since we have such accessible access via our phones, and turn it into something that where at times it's a negative because it remembers and takes care of that for us. Maybe that's the thing for some of us to do. I don't know what your thought would be on if you were going to exercise your brain and needed something. I think that's a really good one.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that, actually, because as a blind person, I can remember back when things weren't really accessible, and to use your, you know, stereo, let's say you knew, like, you know, I have to turn the dial like 5 times to the right and press this button like 6 times and then turn this wherever. I mean, we would think people were crazy if they asked us to do that nowadays, that everything is so accessible. But I do find that I've probably lost that capacity that I used to have to remember all that stuff. So I guess it was just challenging the brain. But yeah, I'd say learning a new language, some sort of like a puzzle or a new skill, anything challenging mm-hmm. to the brain like that. Just the last couple tips, they say, obviously, sleep quality is hugely important, but also meditation, deep breathing, basically managing stress, because apparently stress causes inflammation, and reducing that just increases your overall well-being, and I guess hence risk of dementia. Interesting.
And that's not one I, you know, would think about. I mean, we think about stress for everything, and I guess bottom line is it's the thing to reduce, period, because whether you're worried about dementia, whether you're worried about your heart, whatever, it's that positive thing to do, and we just keep turning the corner and hearing that and physical activity. All the things we know, like you said, no big surprises.
Yeah, exactly. Good, good catalyst for the discussion of mental health as well.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
This is kind of a unique one. There's a company in BC that I read about, and they create paper products out of, or the equivalent of paper products out of bamboo. They're called taboo.
Sounds like something from the old Gilligan's Island show years ago on the island. Hey, you know, here's a sheet of paper. Professor, how can we get more of this? Lots of bamboo.
Yes, I don't know. It sounds like a spell or something, you know. this is interesting. They say roughly 1 million acres of boreal forest actually disappears every day for wood fiber to be used in toilet paper. Like, isn't that insane? Which they say, that's kind of ridiculous. They basically is their philosophy for something that doesn't even have to be pretty. We usually literally just use it for our toilet. So they're actually making the products out of bamboo. And apparently the way they farm the bamboo, it regenerates itself. So unlike clear-cut forests that degenerate the soil have to be replanted. Apparently, their bamboo is, regenerative, and it's not the kind that is eaten by pandas. So that's all good. But apparently, they are actually starting to get to the point where they're going to be selling bamboo-based toilet paper, hopefully expanding to other paper products down the line. And essentially, the point of them is to avoid having more and more trees go to the saw.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of cool.
I love it. And I like what we talked about there about the panda bears and everything like that. But you think about the regenerative, and that is so important, Grant, because it's nice if you can harvest it, cut it down, the stalks or whatever, and zoop, they grow back up. And I believe it is a fairly fast growing bamboo's fairly fast growing, so mm-hmm. I can see that. As you pointed out, I mean, long, you know, I guess we'd complain if the stuff might be too rough or something like that wrong. I wonder on the disposal of it, you know, is there any issue? And again, it's a different kind of bamboo than what we probably picture holding up like the huts on Gilligan's Island or in the hand of a panda bear being chewed back or anything like that. The softness of it, the wonder when flushed, how it demigrates, how it degrades and disappears back into the environment without harming. So I'm sure so many things are discussed, but yeah, I would imagine they're fighting their way to get enough to kind of get this on the market for this to become the way, especially with all the competitiveness of that industry. So we'll see.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah, exactly. I think a part of it is just sort of like, I don't know, tradition of kind of doing things the way they've always been done. Part of it is going to be counter lobbying, whatever, from the big industries that already do it a certain way.
And I think that's the industry that makes things, right? Furniture out of it. Those would be, I'd imagine, the big players.
Yeah, just basically their goal is like, you know, it's up to us to change the way that things are produced. So, kind of cool. Okay, so let's talk about home ownership. I know, for, you know, the majority of people in Canada.
Exactly now.
Sorry, that's kind of snarky. But they're just talking about the dangers of being house poor and what you can do if you are house poor. So in general, at least traditionally, not sure anyone is really doing this in this day and age, but you're supposed to keep your combined living expenses below 30% of your income. So they're talking about pre and post ownership. If it's pre-ownership, consider making a larger down payment if you can to reduce mortgage payments. And also keep in mind that your mortgage is not the same thing as just paying rent every month, because you might have to deal with unexpected expenses such as, you know, repairs to the home, maintenance costs, stuff like that. So make sure to, take that into account. Post-ownership, what do you do if you're feeling the pinch? You might have to go with options like refinancing the home, downsizing, or you can also rent out part of your space if you're comfortable with that, getting a roommate or whatever you have to do. So basically they're just saying, you know, home ownership is this huge pipe dream, but there are a lot of pitfalls to take into account as well.
Wow. Well, the grocery stores make sure that that 30% that you were talking about is not achieved, not easily achieved, regardless of. Yeah, I think, Grant, that's the thing. You know, these are the tips and these are the things that, and I have to be honest, some of that stuff I've heard prior to the pandemic, because food prices have always been the thing people talk about. I don't care if you're talking now or back in the 60s or 50s. It's something that we seem to go get upset about, as if to say, how the heck could this be this expensive? It's only, wait for it, food. And I don't know what to say, because it's always been the topic. It's always the thing. People are, did you see the price of those lamb chops in the grocery store? You heard that in, you know, years ago, especially, and everything is like that. I understand right now things are just out of hand in the amount they're jumping every week, whereas they slip this stuff in at, you know, maybe every 4 or 5 months, or they gradually half a penny, you know, go up. So it is frustrating. It is scary.
It's frustrating. It's scary. And I guess the home ownership has typically been thought of as a pretty solid investment. But yeah, just reminding people there are definitely a lot of pitfalls and other things to consider.
Well, I got to note that Grant will be back with another headline segment on Wednesday. But of course, he'll be back with me on the other side of the break. When we return, we catch up with the host of AMI, the AMI original podcast, Low Vision Moments. Jenny Beaufort will join us. She's going to be highlighting the recent episode, Run for Your Life, with guest Daryl, and the experience of her first half marathon. That conversation ahead after this. Remember to be sure and check out our program wherever you are around the world listening in on AMI Audio. First airing of the show, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, then repeat at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. But the beautiful thing is you can find AMI Audio via TuneIn Radio or OOTunes, any of those great apps. And wherever you are checking us out, thanks for your valuable time. Appreciate having you on board for Kelly and Ramya. It's Kelly McDonald here with Grant Hardy.
Today it is time for our AMI Highlights segment. And, you know, we have so many great podcasts that you can find on any of your favorite podcast streaming services. Today, we are joined by a host of the AMI original podcast, Low Vision Moments, Jenny Beaufort, to catch up with her and learn about the show. Hey, Jenny, so great to talk to you.
Hey, Grant. Hey, Kelly. I'm so happy to be here, even if it is Monday.
Well, thank you for making our Monday a little bit, a lot, actually, happier. Let's talk about the show. Tell us a little bit about the show. How are you enjoying it? And, you know, how far have you gone? How many episodes have you done?
Ooh, well, Low Vision Moments is certainly one of my pride, and it's a big source of pride for me. We have done 3 seasons so far. Our most recent season, we added video. So we're on YouTube now, the most recent season. We're well on to episode number 42 now. The thing I love about being on YouTube, okay, I don't love that I have to do my hair and makeup every time I podcast now. But I'm getting used to it, and it just, it's more accessible this way. I love that we can have captioning there, and now we have transcripts readily available. So I love that. I never get bored of podcasting. The guests I have on each month are just incredible in their own way. We have such light and sometimes deeper conversations, but we mainly try to focus on having a good time. The low vision moments themselves, these are the things that happen when we are just going about our day, when we have partial sight, when we're living with blindness, visual impairment, low vision, whatever your preferred terminology might be, and also albinism, because I live with albinism as well. So we explore all of these topics. We wander into all kinds of different territory and places. But we really want the listeners, whether you have a personal connection to blindness or sight loss or no personal connection, we want you to have a good time, maybe raise some awareness and enjoy our funny stories. That's the main thing.
So what I love about you being on YouTube, Jenny, is we know that there is so much more access out there, people finding you, whether they then find you and go to the or prefer the podcast or love seeing you on YouTube. But there's people just far and wide. Its reach is so phenomenal. I'm curious always what you get from viewers, those who are checking out the show, who love the different perspective. Anything that comes to mind of late that maybe somebody has messaged you somehow, said to you, or said, I'd like to come on the show. I'm in this situation and would love to be a part of it. Or this is what I think about and this is how you brighten my day. Anything?
Yes. So first, let's put that public service announcement out there. If you have any interest on coming on Low Vision Moments as a guest, I always want to hear your funny stories. And I do, Kelly, I do hear from people quite regularly. The most common thing that I hear, and it is so rewarding because it's exactly what we're going for. I want people to be able to relate to the stories. Mm-hmm. And the thing I hear most often is that people, okay, number one, my favorite thing to hear is that when people are out in public listening to the audio version available on all your favorite podcast platforms, I love hearing
commercial in.
Shameless. Absolutely, yes, shameless.
Always. Good work.
Thanks. people, when they tell me that they can't contain their laughter on the bus or out walking their dog, that is what I love to hear, because that is, again, I want to brighten people's day. I want to make you laugh. But the other piece that I hear is that people are just listening or watching and nodding their heads and saying, yes, 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 that happened to me. Because selfishly, that's part of what I want to do with this podcast. There wasn't this content out there for me in this format. And so those are the comments that speak to me, the people who are relating. And the other really cool thing is family members of people who are blind or partially sighted are tuning in, and they're maybe listening with their loved ones. They're maybe listening on their own, and they're getting insight into, oh, maybe that's why my family member does that. Or, you know, maybe I learn how to introduce myself better when I encounter my friend who is visually impaired. And so those are the big pieces that I love to hear.
Well, yeah. I think also that it's okay to laugh at oneself or laugh at the situations. And I think that's something family, especially if someone's more recently, blind or low visioned or physically inconvenienced, as I like to say, whatever, if someone recently is that it's okay to laugh. Now, you also bring on enough guests that give that permission too, because they like to tell their story, but again, surrounded with that laughter and relatability.
You know, what's interesting is a lot of my guests tell me after we've chatted and they've spilled the beans, they've laid down on the therapy couch at times within the recording of the podcast, they come away from it thinking and saying to me rather that they didn't expect to open up that way, and they haven't really opened up that way before. And so just having these conversations, like you said, it normalizes having the conversation. It demystifies things for people who might not have that personal connection. But the more we talk about it, the more normal it is to laugh at these things. Mm-hmm. And you made a really good point. I've had my whole life to deal with this albinism, low vision thing. It's normal to me, but someone who's newer to it, when I get those messages, I'm new to vision loss, and your podcast has really, you know, brightened my day on a couple of occasions. And they don't maybe have that community that some of us have in the blind and low vision community yet. So we're their buddy that they're sitting and chatting with and normalizing those things. And that's super meaningful, but it's all about having a good time as well.
Exactly. I think it's so easy to forget, but we're so low incidence, right? That oftentimes it can just be really, dare I say, like just scary to other people and uncomfortable for us to just have all these little bizarre moments that we don't really know what to do with or how to react to them. And I think being able to just have a little bit of fun with it, both as a blind person, but also maybe a more mainstream audience as well. Like you said, kind of normalize it and just show people that, you know, it doesn't have to be as scary necessarily. We can laugh at these little moments.
And people don't know what they don't know, Grant, right? And that comes up a lot. For example, in the recent episode that came out at the end of March, Mr. Magoo on a Flag is the title of this one. And Dan Baraberger, who's a comedian, writer, and actor, he's written for a series coming to AMI very soon, The Squeaky Wheel Canada. Dan is a very funny human being. So I can't wait to see The Squeaky Wheel Canada. Long time coming, that news satire type of show for us in the disability community. But I digress. The fact that Dan came on, talked about Mr. Magoo on a Flag, you're going to have to listen as to why Mr. Magoo might be on a flag, because that's ridiculousness. But the questions that people get and the interactions that we can't avoid when we're out in public encountering the people who don't know what they don't know, they seem ridiculous to us, right? Dan talks about a story in the episode where someone asked him how he knows when it's raining. And this blows my mind, but it's normal to me that I understand how we know when it's raining, even if we can't see when we look out the window. It seems ridiculous to me, but how we deal with it, it depends on so many factors too, right? When we have those interactions. And so that's the meat and potatoes of the podcast, is how the heck do you deal with those things? And how do you own those stereotypes sometimes when they are real too?
Let's take a listen to a clip from a recent episode titled Run for Your Life. Just a little background. Following her epic road trip of Ostrom through Montana, Daryl was inspired to return and visit their state capital and figured she may as well run her first half marathon road race. But there is one aspect of marathon etiquette that kind of went against her Canadian sensibilities. Let's take a listen.
So it took a year to save up and plan and whatever. And about 6 months before I went on the trip, I was like, well, I wonder if there's any half marathons when I'm traveling, because, well,
that's how we think.
That's how we think. And, you know, hindsight being what it is, I think it was sort of a thing I felt like I needed to prove to myself. You know, I didn't want to run a half marathon in places where I knew anybody. So there happened to be a half marathon in Billings, Montana when I was there. And I was able to get things, you know, set up so I could run it. And I would say my low vision moment of that was because I'd never run a road race before. I'd done like a couple of fundraising 10Ks, but they're, you know, they're pretty chill. They're less intense than, you know, a marathon or a half. And I could not see that people were basically throwing their drink cups on the ground at the aid stations.
Oh, it's the worst.
And I was just like, where's the garbage? And everyone's like, just throw it down, we'll scoop it up. And I'm like, but I'm Canadian, we don't litter. Newsflash, we absolutely do. I got over that really quickly for my next races. But I still kind of want to throw things in the garbage if I can.
A couple minutes left. Let's reflect on this clip.
So for me, talking with Daryl, oh, such a treat. But we were able to compare race notes, which is really nice. She's so much more adventurous, like you heard. She is willing to go out of her comfort zone and like travel to go to races. I stick pretty close to home. She touched on the litter at water stations. And I identify this as possibly the worst ball pit ever, because that's what it feels like when you have to sort of slosh through this and you don't know what the traction's going to be like. It's slippery plastic all over the place. And so
yeah.
Yeah, Daryl is a gem. She's a fellow runner. She's a marathoner, and she's actually got a book. She's included in a book called Run for Your Life, which is just such a good title for a book. And she talks all about her experiences running with guides, which can be just, they're amazing people. It takes such an incredible individual to run, not just a 5, 10, any distance. It takes a really special type of individual, and we're so blessed to have them when we need them. But those navigating those weird things that you don't expect to happen in a race, or on training runs, if you want to find out when it's appropriate to tell someone to go further in the woods, listen to this episode.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Jenny. We've got so much we could cover, but we are pretty much out of time here. But you can catch Jenny's podcast, Low Vision Moments, every Friday on your favorite podcasting app. That was Jenny Bouvard. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
Tremendous stuff. Always really tremendous conversations. Always, Grant.
Okay. Absolutely. We'll see. Lots of moments we can relate to.
Oh, so much. Coming up in the next hour of the program, folks, in light of the high-profile criminal trial of former President Donald Trump taking place in New York, Danielle McLaughlin takes us through what happens in Canada and the United States when a person is called for jury duty. And we listen to a conversation with Robert Cockcroft, director of McMaster University's William J. McCallum Planetarium, to learn all about the Celestial Bear, the Six Nations nighttime show. But up next, folks, Power to Be is a Vancouver-based nonprofit offering outdoor programming for all abilities. We learn more with Kimmy Porter, Carol Yapel, after this.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV.
Second hour of the program, wherever you are, thanks for being with us, checking us out maybe live on AMI TV at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, or our first airing on AMI Audio at 4 p.m. Eastern. It's Kelly and Ramya, and you can listen to, watch, what have you, your pleasure. We're on both networks as a repeat at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and an overnight and first thing in the morning on each network, respectively. Grant Hardy joining me today on the program. All right, Grant. Homework now. You got to whip open the window and check for cherry blossoms. I got to feel that they can't be too far away, but I'm going to call in the cherry blossom expert. Ladies and gentlemen, Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, we visit with our community reporters, and we always find out what's going on in different regions around the country. Today, we're going to Vancouver, and let's welcome in Carol Yapel, our community reporter out there. Carol, have you found those blossoms yet? Grant's been struggling finding them. I couldn't find them the other day here. What's the deal?
Well, hi, Kelly. Hi, Grant. Hi. I think that really we're now seeing the blossoms as a carpet of pink on the ground, more or less.
Well,
I think we're just about done with it. And, you know, it may be because we've had a lot of rain, and it may be that they just fell off a little early. What do you think?
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking, but I'm glad. I was worried that you'd be like, oh yeah, they're all over the place and smell really nice. And I was like, oh, how did I not find them? So I'm glad we're having a similar experience there.
Well, we've been talking
last time. They were a little early this year, I think. And I'm afraid now they're a little early to fall to the ground. So.
Well, and we know it's a short window, right? And that's what we were talking about with our gardener. We talked about that with you, that when they're there, you got to get out, especially if you're going to find them fluttering down, floating, and get yourself caught up in that experience. And I was out tandem biking the other day doing the nose test and having my captain, look, do you see the blossom? They coming in? We've had too much rain. Forget it. Carol, speaking of being out on a bike, another cool thing to do is go out on a great walk. This is a walk. Everyone's welcome with Power to Be.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, this one is going on Vancouver Island. So I had the chance to go over there a couple of weeks ago, and I signed up, and I'm going to go again this coming Sunday, May 5th, from 1 to 3. And this is a walk at a really beautiful place called East Souk. This is just west of Victoria. And it's co-hosted by the Power to Be organization, which operates both on Vancouver Island as well as in North Van and West Van. And the Capital Regional District, which oversees 33 different parks on Vancouver Island. So this particular place has wide paths. It's very flat, and they're opening it up. Power to Be is hard to get into their program sometimes, but this is a free and open event. You do have to register, but you walk down this path and you immediately smell. Here we are with the blossoms again. These are apple blossoms that are coming out, but also it's just on the precipice of the ocean. And you get that ocean breeze like the minute you step off. And they're going to have a guide and naturalists. And I think that they have trail riders for people who require those. So I think it's really just a, you know, embrace of everyone to get out now that the weather is a little bit warmer and better, and take in all of that sensory experience.
I love it. I love the idea, especially smelling things like that, going out, being with other people. But we just, I understand, you know, people who can see, they're looking around. There's so much to see at any given time. But that nose, so many people are learning a lot more about the smells, the wonderful sounds. We talk more about people birding or paying attention to all that stuff. So it's wonderful. And sorry, Grant, I cut you off.
No, it is wonderful. And that organization is so cool because oftentimes, you know, some people with, you know, disabilities are sheltered just inside, or maybe like, okay, there's this one sort of accessible, you know, leisure area, whatever, that we're going to take you to. But that trail rider, I've seen that, and that's pretty serious business. You can do some real hikes and nature trails with that. So that's really cool that they're just helping people basically embrace BC's amazing wilderness and outdoors.
Yeah, and they're having a new program this year called, and it's also free, coming up in the summertime, both in North Van as well as on the island, and it's called Have a Go Days. And I think what that means is have a try. But in any case, they're free and allowing people to, you know, experience being on land, maybe being on the water, and, you know, just taking in what they say is everyone belongs in nature. And, you know, I think sometimes, at least I am reluctant to go out if, I don't know, I'm worried about my vision and I'm unsure. But, you know, the minute I get out there and start smelling those things, like you said, Kelly, and also just feeling the air, I'm invigorated and I'm glad that I pushed past my resistance to get out there.
Yeah,
so important.
To me, it really is. And I know sometimes it's tough, especially when you get thinking, am I up for the walk? Am I going? What if the weather's too warm, too hot, too cold? And you never, ever do something like that and come back home. Oh, no, I shouldn't have gone. There's so many wonderful things. That's awesome.
Awesome. All right. This is something that's very near and dear to our hearts. We're going to hopefully have some news on this on the show later on. But the 13th Annual Abilities Expo taking place in a couple weeks. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. This is hosted by Connectra, which is part of the Disability Foundation, and it's happening on Wednesday, May 22nd between 10 and 5 p.m. It's free, although you do have to register. And this is kind of a combination, a trade show, community gathering, meet new friends, figure out what the latest technology is available and services. And I think hundreds of people come every year just to, you know, be part of the community. And it happens at a beautiful place in Vancouver called the Roundhouse. I don't know if you go there, Grant, very often, but, you know, it's a terrific community center. Mm-hmm. And it's so accessible right there in the Yale Town SkyTrain mm-hmm. station. And it's a welcoming place for disabilities and all kinds of community members. So I'm really looking forward to checking this out. Are you going to be there, Grant?
We're working on it. We're working on doing some coverage, both live on the show and getting some interviews there too. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn.
Yeah, and if that works, Carol, are you going? You're going to be there, right, Carol? You're going to check it out?
Yeah, I'm signed up. Yep.
All right. Very good. Well, Grant, there you got a co-host.
Perfect. Hey, it's
poor
honestly...
Carol's he's sitting there. Hold on. No, hold on. I'm trying to enjoy the day, guys. Leave me alone.
Yeah, until I get an email. Hardy, why are you mentioning future plans? No. Honestly, though, just looking through, you know, the types of presentations and exhibitors that are typically at this event, it's just so huge. Like, I imagine probably would just meet lots of friends, you know, people that I know, but also just take in some amazing organizations that are doing great work and empowering people with disabilities from people with disabilities, too. So it's going to be super.
Awesome. I think when you see these things, you just look at lineups, you look up the people, you look at how much people just want to get out, learn what's there, but also just talk to people. I think these things are absolutely so crucial. Okay. Got all that movement. We walked. And now we're going to go hang out at the Roundhouse, which you know Grant's going to grab something to eat somewhere. But All Bodies Dance Project online. So this is really cool. Carol, one of your online items that so many of us around the world can take part in.
Yeah, that's right. And the All Bodies Dance Project actually is founded about 10 years ago, I think, at the Roundhouse. And they do have in-person classes there. But they do now online on Fridays, every Friday between 12 and 1 Pacific time. And it's a facilitated movement class in which, you know, audio description is so much a part of our lives. But how about feeling like you can move in your own space online, but you're in the community of others. So it's kind of a dance class because it's shared with others, but you can do it in the safety of your own home. And these facilitators are so creative. They kind of make the whole experience of moving your body a kind of meditation, but there's also music. And then there are descriptive scenes where you can enact, you know, being a tree or being a bird, or you can sit in your chair or you can stand up. But they're so creative and they make it available. This is also through Connectra on Fridays for free as an online program. And I've done it the past few weeks. It's so much fun. And it's also a nice community. Not all in Vancouver, but, you know, throughout Canada and even some people from the States. So I encourage people to move inside as well as outside.
Well, and it's so many of us have the concerns of either going somewhere or how do I feel? How am I going to learn something if I'm not necessarily, unfortunately, some of us, our sense of spatial, it may be challenging. And I think when you have something like this that you can move your chair, move a table, or not even have to, but you know your space, Carol, it's magical when something like this is offered to you.
Yep. Allbodiesdance.ca.
It's great. I have participated as well in person. Great that they're moving online too. It's going to make it a lot more accessible and just make arts and entertainment and dance accessible to more people. It's going to be super.
Tremendous. Thanks, Carol.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And Grant and Carol will be out mowing up or vacuuming up all those blossoms out there. That's making a mess because we just don't want them done, right? Want to keep them in the air, keep that smell alive. Anyway, we visit with our community reporters Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. That was Carol Yapel talking to us about some things from Vancouver. We step aside for a couple of moments, and when we return, we listen to a conversation with Robert Cockcroft, director of McMaster University's William J. McCallion Planetarium. This is where we were in Hamilton during the eclipse. Today, we're going to be learning about the Celestial Bear. This is the Six Nations Night Sky Show. I'm telling you, what a conversation ahead. Please, hang in for it. We'll be back with it after this. Mark marketing and communications folks at AMI keeping us on our toes. A message came out a little while ago, sent out to so many of you out there in our listening audience to remind you about free tickets, because you got to get your tickets to laugh again. AMI and Halifax Comedy Fest are filming a second all-access comedy special. Now, the All Access Comedy is a stand-up special unlike any other out there, with comedians from the disability community getting together to celebrate their unique outlook on life for a packed house. The next All Access Comedy will be filmed on Sunday, May 12th. Wow, that's just around the corner, folks. That's at 3 p.m. Atlantic time at the Spats Theater in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So please, please, please get your tickets now. I threw that word in there a while ago. Free. Fill the house. This is, you can go to reserve your free tickets at halifaxcomedyfest.ca. Take it in, folks. The first one was great. This one's going to, of course, you know it, be better. Kelly McDonald with Grant Hardy.
All right. Fantastic. Earlier this month, we interviewed Robert Cockcroft, director of McMaster University's William J. McKillian Planetarium, and that was to learn about all things about the Celestial Bear, the Six Nations Night Sky Show. Let's give this a watch.
Robert Cockcroft is an assistant professor and of physics and astronomy and director of McMaster University's William J. McKillian Planetarium. I want to talk to him today about the Celestial Bear, but Professor, welcome to the show, and would you do me a favor and describe this fantastic shirt you've got on as we sit here chatting on the day of the eclipse?
Yeah, good morning, and thanks for that nice invite and introduction. So I'm wearing a black T-shirt that has a white circle on it, and that's showing the diamond ring effect, which is, and then the date underneath, today's date, April 8th, 2024. And the diamond ring is, because the moon isn't perfectly spherical, it has mountain ranges and craters in it. There will be a moment just before totality, just before the moon completely covers the sun, when there'll be a tiny piece of the sun shining through the mountain ranges, the craters on the moon, and it creates a very bright patch on one side of the moon, and then there's a ring around the rest of the moon, and so that's why it's called the diamond ring effect, and that's the T-shirt that all our staff at the university are wearing today, who are helping out at the event at the back of campus.
That's amazing. Even the thought of that, because so many of us sit here, we just expect that, oh, it'll edge over, and a circle. I'm here, though, today to talk to you about the Celestial Bear. It's a tremendous, would the best way to call it a description or conversation when we think about it as its importance to increase knowledge around indigenous astronomy. I mean, the show itself has really garnered quite a bit of popularity. So would that be the best way to sum it up? Just simply say, hey, this fantastic show, talk, enlightenment.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So at the Planetarium here at McMaster, we give over 300 shows per year, and the Celestial Bear show is the most requested show. Even 9 years later, after we helped co-produce it with our Indigenous scholar collaborators, Tom Deere, David Moses, and Professor Rick Montour.
That's amazing. Like 9 years. Okay, let's go and talk a little bit about colonization and how it has impacted indigenous astronomy knowledge out there, particularly the way it's viewed.
So colonization, when we say that word, we're usually thinking of the colonization of land.
Yes.
But in our context here at the university, we also remember very often the colonization of the sky above us. And so that can mean, for example, not only are the stories themselves stolen, the stories of the sky, but light pollution, modern day light pollution, is also stealing our connection, not just for indigenous people, but non-indigenous people. It's stealing the connection we have with the sky as well, because we can no longer see the stars and planets. So many people have never seen the Milky Way, for example. Our own galaxy have never seen it, just because we have so much light pollution. So that's another form of colonization, not just the land, but also the sky.
I never really think about it that way, but I understand the disconnect. Even as a child, and people talking about the sky, and always hearing people say, and of course today, well, you got to get away from the lights to enjoy this. Anytime anything's going on, oh, you've got to get out to the country to really
experience it. What initiatives will this project introduce to kind of give us some more of that knowledge around astronomy?
So it's another way that the show helps people realize, for non-Indigenous people, the connection that Indigenous people have with the sky. It's just one example. There are many connections, but this is just one example. And it's also a nice way to think about how the sky works. Rather than trying to memorize facts, you learn a story. And many people, myself included, it's easy to remember a story rather than memorizing facts.
Yeah.
So, and you can relate the story to other people in a very nice fashion. So you can, just remembering the story, you remember how the sky works, how it moves over the course of the night, how it moves if you're in different locations, how it moves if you're in different seasons of the year. All of those things, you don't have to remember the facts, you just remember the story. And it's easy to remember the story, and you're automatically remembering the things about the sky.
Do we think back, especially to the importance of the sky, that roadmap that I'm sure so many Indigenous people would have counted on, and how is that reflected in the storytelling, the importance? I mean, we can sit here today, say we can predict when there's going to be an eclipse, but how does that happen in the sense of importance, more importance for that sky when there is no light pollution, when there is no compasses guiding you from, it's your life experience. How much of that is felt in the storytelling?
I'd say it's felt very... it's one of the first things that you realize, I think, that there is a tremendous connection between how... for the Six Nations, for the Celestial Bear specifically, it's a Six Nations story. And so we're thinking about how the story for Six Nations people has been important since time immemorial, but also is still relevant for today, and how... it can, for example, determine the start of the hunting season. It can determine when to plant, when to harvest. It can determine when ceremonies are happening.
Right.
So it's all relevant things for today, still today. There's a misconception that, oh, the stories are of historical importance, but they're still relevant. The misconception we help address in the planetarium is that it's still relevant today, and you can still see the stories being told in the sky today and how they impact lives on the ground today.
It's really interesting when you think about the very beginnings of it, and when you look at the Six Nations Night Sky Planetarium show, that is just some of the ways that it influenced the show, isn't it? Is there other ways or anything else that we should touch on?
So yeah, I would say for me personally, working with Tom Deer, who was the person, the Indigenous scholar who came to us and said, I have this idea for a show, would you be interested in working with us? And we said yes, we would love to do that, because we give shows on many different topics, whether it's historical or things that the media is picking up on, different cultural ideas, things that we're interested in our own research. So all these different topics we're used to talking about in the planetarium. And we had wanted to do an Indigenous themed show, but none of us on our team currently are Indigenous.
Right.
And our research areas are not Indigenous themed, so we didn't feel it was appropriate that we would do that ourselves. And so when Tom said, couldn't we work together, and Tom is Mohawk, we said, yes, this will be great, this will be fantastic, let's do this. And he, in working with him to produce that first show, that's what started me on my own journey, contributing towards decolonization and reconciliation, and thinking about how and it sounds stupid now when I say it, but when I struggled at first, when I started, because I'm originally from the UK, so I was very ignorant about Indigenous peoples in Canada. When I first started learning about colonization here in Canada, I didn't know how to help. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to realize, well, my astronomy is in background. My background is in astronomy,
mm-hmm.
So that's where I help, in astronomy. And so, it has spurred us working on. So we have this one planetarium show now that we worked with Tom on, which is to do with the Celestial Bear. We're working on another one right now, which we hope to launch later in the summer, which is on the Seven Dancers, which is associated with the Pleiades. We have a new indigenous astronomy course that we offer to undergraduates, which is blending perspectives from both the Western and Eurocentric ideas and indigenous ideas on astronomy, knowledge, ways of thinking about the sky, how we relate to the sky. And then we've also now got a portable planetarium as well as the fixed facility here on campus. And we're able to take that portable planetarium to communities, and we have taken it to many indigenous communities so far, so that we can share stories not just on campus for people who can come to campus, but we can take the stories to them, to their home communities, and in the comfort of the home communities, which has been fantastic. So it's spurred up, this one show has spurred a lot of interest and excitement and projects that have just flourished and continue to flourish.
Well, Professor Cockcroft, what really gets me, and I start thinking back as to not just that roadmap in the sky to get somewhere, but spreading the word from communities to communities back when that related to the things seen in the skies, the experiences such as an eclipse, you know, hundreds of years ago, and how the indigenous communities viewed them, how they passed the word on, how they recognized those effects when it comes to farming, when it comes to existence, and it comes to the movement. So I think that is tremendous. Celestial Bear, where does the name come from?
So it's not my place to tell the story, but the story includes a great bear that was initially on the ground, and then because it's a magical bear, it has powers, it transports itself up into the sky where it remains today, and we can still see it.
Wow. Yeah. Excellent. The storytelling must be just tremendous, the experience, and I love the fact of traveling, especially for people who aren't able to necessarily enjoy or understand or really have taken it in. Can you think for me, in your mind, how will this project down the road, beyond astronomy, have an impact?
So I think, like we mentioned at the start of this conversation, the way that the colonization has happened and it's stolen a lot of this material, even from indigenous peoples themselves. So while non-indigenous people can learn about this story, it's also, I have heard from indigenous audiences, it's been really powerful for them. They know the story, but they didn't necessarily know the connection with the sky. They couldn't visualize the connection with the sky, but we can show that in the planetarium. And then also the fact that we are a Western Eurocentric institution at McMaster University, and here we are showcasing indigenous knowledge with our indigenous collaborators.
And getting asked 9 years later, hey, when's that show come around again? Or can you bring it to my community? I think it's powerful. I mean, we all recognize there's been a lot more discussion, learning about indigenous communities, lifestyle, and looking at the readings of the stars, the viewpoint. It's just a wonderful, I want to say full circle, as I think of our globe and what it must mean, but what a place to close your eyes and go back to and imagine. Professor, anything else in closing?
I would just say it's changed perspectives for many people in the audience, and it's also personally changed my perspective on the way I view the sky, for which I'm really grateful that I've had this chance to and continue to have these chances to work with our Indigenous scholar collaborators.
Wow. Thank you for giving us time, explaining it to us. I know you got a really busy day. Robert Cockcroft, of course, an assistant professor of physics and astronomy and director of McMaster University's William J. McCallum Planetarium. We've been talking about the Celestial Bear.
Really fascinating chat, Kelly, with Professor Robert Cockcroft. And just the knowledge that they have, the energy predicting things down to the second. I can't get over that. Fantastic.
I love the inclusiveness, Grant. He really was great. But that day, you just have to, the campus was buzzing, and what a chance to promote so many of the things they do outside of what we were all there to experience at the stadium and everywhere else with the eclipse. So a big, big thank you to them, to everyone on at the school. McMaster really rolled it out, did it well for a very special day. Thank you. Folks, coming up next as we step aside, in light of the high-profile criminal trial of former President Donald Trump, folks, this is taking place in New York. Danielle McLaughlin takes us through what happens in the U.S. and in Canada when a person, you or I, are called for jury duty. Stay tuned. A little later on, we'll tell you how to check out the podcast, but I mean, you can easily do a search for us. We'll give you a little more details on that, mention a few other things. So stick around for the program. We'll also tee up what we've got for you on tap tomorrow and a great closing moment. But Grant Hardy and I, at this time on Mondays with this program, we love to talk knowing our rights. No matter what, Grant, I mean, there are different people out there in this world, and we get a chance to talk on this segment about some of that, some of the things that they do or don't do, maybe even trying to pick their own jury. But anyway, I digress. Let's bring on Danielle McLaughlin.
Did you know that everyone has rights? No matter who we are, we all qualify. But what happens when freedoms collide? The answers are rarely simple, but always interesting. Join me, Danielle McLaughlin, to talk about civil liberties and human rights on Know Your Rights.
Oh, sorry, guys. Just a moment. I'm just lighting this fuse here. Many of us have been following the high-profile criminal trial of former President Donald Trump that is taking place in New York. One of the significant issues at the beginning of the trial was jury selection. We're going to look at what happens in the U.S. and in Canada when a person is called for jury duty. Because, I mean, after all, we all know you're called, and then the person who's on trial gets to pick out who they want on their jury. Danielle McLaughlin, welcome back. How are you?
I'm well. How about you guys? Everybody doing well?
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Good, we good. Were talking about your favorites, the cherry blossoms, today a bit on the show and last week. Did you enjoy them this year?
I really did. In fact, I've gone to about four different places to see them this year. And one of the things that I discovered that I thought was really lovely, I have a family member with mobility issues, and I discovered that there is a certain place you can go where you don't need to get out of a vehicle in order to see all of them. And it was it was really nice to know that, you know, because High Park, which is the famous one in Toronto, is really not accessible because they close off the roads. And in fact, if you have a mobility issue, it's really difficult to get there. Whereas this other place in Centennial Park in Etobicoke, you can drive, you can see all the trees. And I thought that made me feel really good to know that that was available.
Oh, man, what a nice option to be able to take them in. Well, we've been sitting there talking about it. I was out on a bike ride the other night looking for them. And now I think that ship has sailed here, possibly, especially with all the rain. But so wonderful. Yeah. Okay. All right. Why do democracies require juries?
Well, you know, I started out by thinking about, I have to confess, I'm sort of as you know, a political and legal junkie. and, you know, if you, you know, recall your history, you'll remember that according to the old British law system, the king was the arbiter. And if you were a lord, you would be the judge over whether your serfs had committed an offense. And if you think about it, quite a conflict of interest. So that if, for example, something had been stolen from your palace, not only would you accuse them and try them, you would also punish them. But when we moved into democracies, we came up with this idea that people should have the right to be tried by a jury of their peers. And that means your equals, people who are in law, at any rate, in the same position that you are, so that they aren't above you the way the lord in the olden times would have been, or the king. Yet here in Canada, we still speak of criminal cases as RV, whoever it is who's being accused. So that means it used to be Regina, it's now Rex, the king versus the person who's been accused. In the States, if you're watching the Trump trial, you'll see it's the people of New York versus Donald Trump. So the people now have taken over that particular role. So juries are trying to make, the idea of a jury at any rate, is to try to make things more equitable and to give people a fair chance at being found, at having the truth found of what has actually happened.
I think federally in the U.S., it's the United States versus whomever, right?
That's right. That's right.
All right. Single with Canada, who is eligible to serve on a jury in Canada?
Okay, you have to be over 18 years of age, and you have to be a Canadian citizen. You cannot have been convicted of an indictable offense. And you have to be physically able or and mentally able to serve. Those are the basic requirements.
Okay. So is that the same in the States?
Well, I think it's 19 in the States. You have to be an American citizen. You have to be able to read and speak English in the United States. Here, there are some accommodations, but basically English and or French should be available to you. We have a long list of people who aren't eligible, quite different from the people in the United States. So, for example, in the United States, it's just, you know, citizens and who are also resident and, don't have a criminal conviction for certain kinds of crimes. But here, if you are a member of the Senate or House of Commons, if you're a sheriff, if you're a lawyer or a law student, a doctor or a dentist in practice, in active practice, if you're a corrections officer, a probation or police officer, if you are a firefighter, if you are a judge or a justice of the peace or another officer of the court, or if you are a member of the armed forces on active service, you are not eligible to serve on a Canadian jury. In the United States, active military also cannot be put on juries. But you may notice that among the people who are sitting on the Trump trial are a number of lawyers. That would not be permissible here in Canada.
And you wonder about police officers and members of the court. Mm-hmm. I think I'm puzzled about dentists and was it doctors? Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes, in active practice. And I think the idea, and firefighters, is that these people are so important to the to the community that we can't take them away from their employment.
And that does make sense. That's what I was thinking, that when you listed them, that's what I thought, that the importance of their job, you know, we can't afford to have them not available.
We can't, exactly.
I was really overthinking this. I was almost wondering if it would be because forensic evidence or whatever would be interpreted maybe in a different way than just your peer would interpret it. But your explanation is much more reasonable.
But you know what, Grant? We're going to get to that. Because that's a different step, and you could be right.
So I'm going to ask you, how are jurors chosen? But I would also just like you to throw in, you know, people with disabilities. I know people have fought for the right for blind people, let's say, to be on juries. Where does that stand, and how are jurors chosen?
Because we've been discriminated against.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is, and that's a really important issue. There have been a number of court cases having to do with that. The system, the justice system, is obliged by law to accommodate people with disabilities, if possible. So there's a good question. What does that mean? Well, it means, for example, that deaf jurors can demand a sign language interpreter. I'm not sure how it would work in certain trials for people who are blind or who have low vision. In general, please forgive me for this, but you know the saying, justice is blind, which should mean that blind people should be specifically eligible to serve on juries. But if, for example, there's a great deal of visual evidence, that might make it more difficult. Can that person have the evidence described to them? Is that going to be the same, equal to jurors I don't know the answer to that.
I've heard even things like the eye contact, even the ways that a lawyer may choose, if they're more confident that they can look at Danielle and convince you with their eyes, but I can look at that Kelly guy and all I see is rolling eyes. No, I can't do anything with that.
Well, exactly.
Don't want them on my jury.
people who are the accused too, you know, oh, this person looks a little rough around the edges. I don't really like the looks of this guy. Like, that's something where a blind person would almost be in an advantage to justice.
Well, yes. And we do certainly have judges who are blind, right. You know, not right. a lot, mind you, but you know, that doesn't hamper that particular job. We certainly know lawyers who are blind and, you know, do wonderful work. So, you know, what happens is that people who are on the voters list in Canada are sent a questionnaire randomly. So the questionnaire comes to you and you are obliged by law to fill it out. It goes back into the pool. And then from those who are seen to be eligible because of what they've said on their questionnaire, in other words, they don't belong to an excluded profession, or have physical illnesses or disabilities that will keep them from being able to serve, however that could be defined. Then those people who filled out the questionnaire, those go into a pot. And then when it is time to call a jury, a whole raft of people who have answered the questionnaire are brought in. Now, just because you're called for jury duty does not mean you're going to serve on a jury. So a bunch of people are called in. A jury generally will have no more than 12 people. Sometimes there are alternates, depends on the trial. And people will then be called up and they will be asked a very set series of questions. Now, the Crown, the prosecution, has the same questions as the defense. Those questions are for both of them. But everybody has a certain number of peremptory exclusions. So in other words, somebody can look at a potential juror and say, yeah, no, I don't want that guy. They don't have to say why. For a certain number of peremptory exclusions. They can also exclude people for cause. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a rather vivid imagination. And I was imagining the jury selection in the Trump trial, because one of the very first questions that people are generally asked is, can you make a fair and impartial decision in this case? And the cases, you know, so for example, if there is a case in which somebody you know is being tried, you will be excluded if you say, no, I can't because, you know, that's my grandmother or that person lives next door to me. So, you know, you will be excluded that, you know, so you have a reason to be excluded, maybe because there's a conflict of some kind. I had this imagination of people who really feel very negatively to Donald Trump being asked if they could make a fair and impartial decision and expounding for quite a period of time on why they could not. They want to be excluded from jury duty, but they also want the opportunity, because he's sitting right there, to tell him exactly why they could not.
Yeah, I think, and Danielle, that's the way to go, as opposed to what I really thought of. Oh, yes, of course I could. Why is your nose growing?
Here's a really interesting thing about juries. I've read a bit about jury trials. And one of the things that I find remarkable is you take a random group of people who come from all walks of life, except for the designated few. You put them in a room together. You tell them the same information. You have a judge explaining the law to them. And on the whole, they take it very seriously. They put aside their prejudices and their preconceived notions. And they come up, on the whole, with a fair decision. And they really do seek the truth in cases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's a really wonderful part of democracies, that we really have an expectation that when called upon, each and every one of us will do our very best come up with a fair decision.
Yeah, well, and Danielle, that's being privileged enough in our country, lucky enough to be able to do something like this and having the right to do so. Danielle, I do have a question submitted by Ramya, though. Do jurors get paid?
Aha. Do jurors get paid? Well, it depends, as you know, every time you ask a question. For the first period of time, they do not get paid. I think the first period is 10 days. If a trial goes longer than that, then yes, they will get paid. And then if it goes past a certain length of time, the pay goes up. It's not great. I don't think jurors ever get more than $100 a day. If they are impaneled, they will get meals. They will, generally speaking, be allowed to go home at night. There are a few things that jurors in Canada are told. And one of the things that they are told is you don't get to talk about the trial until after the trial is completely finished. You don't get to talk to your family or your friends or anyone about it. You don't, and this was true in the United States as well, you don't get to use social media while the trial is ongoing. You can't read about the case in the newspapers or anywhere in media, any sort of media. You can't watch the news that where it covers this. All of this is very important. Not terribly long ago, there was a case in which a juror had decided that she wanted to find out more about what had been, what she was hearing about in the case that she was on which she was impaneled. And she went to the location where the incident had occurred. She said she was doing her own research. Well, that was a mistrial.
That's intense. Jurors, yeah.
Yeah. And jurors are only allowed to make their decisions based on the evidence that is presented in court. And they are instructed by the judge on how to apply the law that is at hand. So, you know, people who think that they can just, you know, I can do this on my own. No, you can't, and you're not.
Yeah. No,
you
know, exactly.
You could actually be making you could be held in contempt of court, which is an offense. You know, people have gone to jail for contempt of court. So you don't want to mess with that kind of stuff, right?
No. Danielle, wrapping real quick because we're out of time. Yeah. We know that some of the potential jurors in the Trump trial have been concerned, you know, about their safety. Does your identity when you're on a trial can it be made public in Canada, and can people refuse to be on the jury?
Well, you can't. You have to have a good reason to refuse to be on the jury. Or one of the best ones is I can't make an impartial decision in this case. But it may be that you're in the middle of moving house, you are ill, or a close family member is ill. There may be some good reasons for refusing jury duty. On the whole, though, you can't. It's a requirement by law. And in Canada, your identity is not made public. In the United States, jurors after a trial will speak to the media. In Canada, you are not allowed to speak publicly about the case at all. Full stop. It's over. Your identity is not shared. In the United States, they've had cases where they've said it's a matter of freedom of expression. The media should be able to get access to who the jurors are. As you've seen in the Trump trial and some others, like if there's a a major criminal trial, they will hide the identities of jurors.
Thank you, Danielle. Fantastic. We're way over. We will talk to you next week. Great topic.
Thank you. Bye now.
Our Know Your Rights contributor, Danielle McLaughlin, talking about jury duty. On the other side of the break, well, first of all, we'll do this again next Monday when we have her on. On the other side of the break, however, we wrap up the show. We'll see what's coming up on our edition of our program tomorrow. I'll tell you what the gang over at Now with Dave Brown has for you. And the Hubble telescope. Hey, it's time to celebrate about it. I'll get into that in a moment. Here we go, folks. Lots to cover off before we wrap today's program. I hand it over to Grant Hardy. He's going to tell us a little bit about what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown at 9 a.m. in the morning Eastern Time on AMI TV.
The Sault Ste. Marie Airport Authority is actively engaging with people in the disability community to improve accessibility, and community reporter Dorothy McNaughton is going to give us the details on that. Also, nearly 8,000 Ukrainian refugees have settled in Saskatchewan, and that has led to a strain on services in the province. Freelance journalist John Lupke has more.
Okay, they're on at 9 a.m. in the morning, but Got you covered, folks. You can subscribe to their podcast just like you can ours. We both shows appreciate a rating and review if you have some time. You can listen to the show in segment form or the complete show. Our program, we ought to add on an audio vanity card on the complete show itself. That's the podcast. Go ahead, please subscribe when you get a moment and check them out. Okay. An anniversary. The Hubble telescope celebrates 34 years. This is by Shaneel Kuthner. This was just recently published. Thanks to the Hubble telescope, astronomers know our universe is about 13.7 billion years old and that many galaxies host supermassive black holes at their centers. It's because of this spaceborne eye on the cosmos that scientists were also able to map this mysterious dark matter in 3D. The Space Telescope is the most scientific, productive astrophysics mission in NASA history. The demand for using Hubble is so high, it's oversubscribed by about 6-1, folks. So to celebrate 34 years of Hubble, the astronomers unveiled an image taken of the Dumbbell Nebula, or M76, which is a two-lobed expanding shell of gas shed by a dying star at the center, located 3,400 light-years from Earth in the constellation Perseus. The star sizzles at temperatures exceeding 130,000 degrees Celsius, roughly 24 times our sun's surface, making it one of the most hottest stellar images that we can find by the Hubble telescope. Wow. And of course, dumbbell. Wow. Well, that's because the stars around it, the layers look like a dumbbell layer around it. So fantastic, Grant. Always love to know about those things. Love to think about it, especially when we talk about more images being made accessible to us in one form or another. Yeah. Buddy, so great. Thank you for being with us today. I think we'll have you back later in the week.
Fantastic. Always way too much fun.
Oh, yeah, you betcha. That's the name of the game here. The show is called Fun. We heard Jenny Bovart say it earlier. We're saying it here as well. Tomorrow on our book club, we discuss The Rosie Project by Graham St. John, the first book of a trilogy about a man's journey to find love. And we're going to review it with the person who suggested the book to us. You know her. Producer Beth Deer on our program.
Are you attached to your smartphone and is it literally causing you pain? Maybe I am. Learn tips and tricks on how to minimize the overuse of your hands on Wellness with Francis Wong.
I say nothing. In court, I plead the fifth in American style.
You and me both.
The door is off to you, folks. We're waving at you. Talk to you tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Hi, I'm Red Sail, inviting you to download the latest episode of My Life in Books, where internationally acclaimed authors discuss their lives, their work, and three books that have resonated with them. That's My Life in Books, available wherever you get your AMI podcasts.